It's a privilege to be here. I've not had the opportunity to speak at an APA meeting before, but it's a real joy to see a number of colleagues here and to find an interest in our profession within this vast community. I was surprised to see that you can't help but be impressed with the numbers of people who attend these conferences. I have the privilege to speak with you today on outcomes that we're following in the use of Murphy-Perot procedure in patients with spastic equinus. And I've got a lot of slides and a short time to give them, so I'm going to try to rush through them. They're not all title slides, so you get a chance to see some pictures as well. CP is the second most expensive developmental disability to manage over the course of a person's lifetime. It's second only to mental retardation. The average lifetime cost per person in the United States is $921,000. It's a very expensive disease to deal with, and it is therefore an issue that affects public health as well as the medical community itself. The incidence in developed countries is about 2.12 to 2.45 per thousand, which is higher even than the incidence of clubfoot or some of the other deformities that we see, what we consider to be commonly seen. We know that only for developed countries. We don't know it for undeveloped countries, and we are being more and more influenced by undeveloped countries as we develop our policies and procedures over time. Interestingly, the incidence even in developed countries has not declined over the last 60 years. And one of the beliefs for that, one of the reasons we think that happens is because there's been higher and higher survivability of neonates with neonatal intensive care efforts. So we know that CP has something to do with the development of children. We believe that about 75% occur during pregnancy, about 5% occur during childbirth, and there are about 15% of people affected by the disorder even after childbirth. It's a non-progressive disorder, meaning the brain damage does not seem to worsen beyond the initial insult, but there are a number of secondary orthopedic deformities that have to be addressed. The one that we're going to be most concerned about today is spastic equinus. Now, cerebral palsy is the most common cause of spastic equinus. It's caused by the fixed non-progressive brain lesion. The original lesion tends to occur prenatally, as you mentioned, the primary disorder affecting the musculoskeletal system. And the greatest handicap from it is a lack of motor control. There are a number of different types of cerebral palsy. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this other than just to flash them up to let you know I've done my homework on these issues. Most of the healthcare providers here are familiar with these. The distribution of the paralysis tends to be either one limb or several limbs. It can extend all four limbs. Double hemiplegia is the most common type that we see in our project down in Mexico, which is the Yucatan Crippled Children's Project. It's a project that we began in 1996. We did our first surgery July 4th, and it continues to this day. It's an affiliation project between Barry University and the Department of Health of the state of Yucatan in Mexico. We attempted to pattern it after the Baja Project. We've been very successful over the years in building the relationship between America and Mexico in that particular part of the world. Just a point of order here, we're going to be focusing obviously on that part of the disease that affects the lower extremity most specifically. There is fixed spastic disorder of the lower extremity, and that's a contracture that it persists even with general anesthesia. There's a dynamic contracture that can be resolved somewhat with physical therapy. And there is mixed, which is the most typical type that we see in our project down in Mexico. Again, I'm going to skip through a lot of these fairly quickly. Just mention the most important points of the aspects of cerebral palsy that are going to influence our study. In cerebral palsy, oftentimes the disorder is not picked up until later on in development. And the first signs can be the loss of motor or grasp reflexes, a notice on the part of the parents of standing or sitting balance disorders, an inability to crawl. One of the things that is drummed into us with training is that normally children will rise up and start to cruise at 6 to 9 months, meaning they'll pull themselves up next to a coffee table or a sofa. And then between 9 and 12 months, they should start taking their first steps. If it goes over 14 to 16 months before first steps, then often there's something wrong. And a lot of times that cause of that, what is wrong, is missed until they're much later, 2 or 3 years of age. and at times it may be more difficult to intervene later on in life. So picking out the disorder early is important. There's also lack of understanding in basic CP management. It's important to qualify the fact that performing any kind of a heel corridor lengthening procedure on a child without any independent sitting balance and any potential for locomotion is really out of order. It's something that shouldn't be done. And so I want to emphasize that we don't operate on every child with cerebral palsy. We do select the population, but among that population that have been selected, the outcomes have been very good. It all starts with a lower extremity evaluation. Frequently find the disorder accompanied by spastic adduction deformity of the hip with spastic hamstrings and adductor muscles. We also often see knee joint flexion with combinations of hyperextension or hyperflexion that influence the overall outcome, and those have to be addressed in order for us to do any good at the level that we're going to be intervening. We look at posture and stance and gait. We look at the nature and the severity of the deformity. And we look especially at the hips. If the hips are influencing, then we work together with our orthopedic colleagues in Mexico, and we will do reductions, procedures, tenotomies of the adductors and the knee flexors, the hamstrings. Now, that's not surgery we normally do here in the United States. Obviously, we've gained a lot of experience doing it down in Mexico, but we're careful to stay within the purview of our expertise, and this is not something we do independently. We always do it with an orthopedic surgeon. We also need to look at muscle strength. There has to be a capacity for some muscle strength. We look at the physiologic status. We determine whether there's a clonus to validate the disorder. And we look at to differentiate the type of cerebral palsy from spastic from athetoid. Spastic cerebral palsy shows up in deep tendon reflex testing and the silver skyloid test, which is the essential qualifier to determine the type of equinus. We classify equinus biomechanically as either compensated or uncompensated. Compensated equinus would be one in which the heel touches the ground but pops off prematurely. And uncompensated equinus would be one in which the heel never gets down to the ground at all. This is an example of a little boy with uncompensated equinus who has true CP. If you look at him, his heel never gets to the ground. He goes through life walking on his tippy toes, most often assisted by his parents. There are other causes for this. This is a little girl who, when she was 4 years old, got caught on a curb and a car ran over her leg and wound up rubber burning her so that she is now left with a real severe equinus that is not neurologic and would require an intervention other than the type of intervention that we're proposing here, the Murphy-Perot type procedure. Conservative treatment should always be considered in any of these. They include physical therapy. They do actually work with us a lot down there in physical therapy. We have a full-time therapist that helps us. We do what we can to provide orthotic support. We're limited. We can do foot orthoses. We can do some ankle foot orthoses, but we have trouble locating prosthetics that go up into the leg. We've been trying to develop an affiliation agreement, but it's interesting. Prosthetics and orthotics is a discipline that is the only remaining discipline that is projected to have a health manpower shortage through the year 2010. There are very few schools. We've been talking some time about maybe even starting one at Barry University, but getting it up and going is quite a process. In considering orthotics, it's important to know that you can do more harm with an incorrectly prescribed orthotic device than no orthotic device at all. An orthotic device that immobilizes a limb and prevents movement can actually advance the musculoskeletal consequence of the disorder. One of the great lessons from Forrest Gump was that in order for him to run, he had to first break loose from his braces. And the family doctor took credit for being responsible for teaching him to run, when in fact the family doctor probably hindered him from doing so. And that gets back to a basic premise that we all understand in healthcare, and that is primum non nocere, first do no harm. to first do no harm, we have to understand what harm can be done and be careful to avoid those pitfalls. Overcorrection can lead to the opposite, rocker bottom, flat foot, and other issues that have to be dealt with. Exercises are almost always good to do. Gait training without crutches is best. And starting these children on this type of training before the procedure is even done is a good thing, because it will be easier to get them to comply with it afterwards. Now, I point out, this is not the way that we teach our kids how to do it. We don't teach them to rest their armpits on the crutch, because that places the brachial plexus in jeopardy. But when we went down there, we saw them doing it this way. We said, this is not the way we want you to do it. We want you to teach them to push the crutches into the rib cage, not into the armpit. Night splints are seldom effective in cerebral palsy. Another one of the invasive treatments that we'll talk about just on the way to discussing our primary procedure is the use of Botox. We have been able to secure some and use it. It's very expensive. And it has been helpful in a number of cases, particularly potential reoccurrences in knee flexions. We'll correct the hamstrings and the adductors, the hip adductors, with tenotomies, and we'll do the Murphy-Perot procedure, and then in 2-3 years, they start to contract in the upper portions of the leg, and we find if we go in with Botox, we can resist those contractures or reverse them in some cases. So that's kind of an exciting new dimension for Botox that goes beyond the facial plastic surgery enthusiasm for it. So the surgical objective of what we want to do specifically is to improve motor function, to get the heel down to the ground. The motor handicap that these patients have to live with can be substantially improved with surgery, although it's important to emphasize to the parents that the child will never be completely normal. We can't completely reverse the disease. The best we can do is hopefully improve their quality of life. Prior to surgery, we do emphasize the employment of conservative measures, and we observe any changing patterns of the paralysis. Tendo-Achilles procedures have been around for a long time. One of the traditional procedures that were recommended to treat this was tendo-Achilles lengthening, and that is the majority of procedures that are done. With tendo-Achilles lengthenings, the initial results that were reported in treating cerebral palsy spastic equinus were very favorable. They said that they had success rates of 25% to 75%. However, over longer terms, those rates did not hold up. They found that the constant neurologic override of the flexor muscle groups became dominant, and with time, most tendo-Achilles lengthenings, per se, are not successful with CP. That's been pretty well documented by a number of different studies that I'll show you in a minute. The reoccurrence rates, we know, are at least 15% to 30%, and there's some more recent literature that suggests that they're much higher than that. The reoccurrence is secondary to the inability of spastic musculature to grow functionally at the same rate of the long bones, and therefore flexors override extensors. Tricep surgery causes 3 epiphyseal plates and accounts for 85% of the growth in the length of the lower extremity. So now let's talk about our primary procedure, which is an anterior advancement of the Achilles tendon history, Achilles tendon complex. The procedure was originally proposed, at least in literature, by Delpech back in 1816, who talked about a subcutaneous sectioning of the tendo-Achilles. This is not really a transposition. This is just doing something to the Achilles tendon to deal with equinus. In 1931, Little was the first one to successfully treat cerebral palsy, per se, with a tendo-Achilles lengthening, getting the heel down to the ground. Esteve in 36 described the concept of, instead of just releasing the tendon, advancing the tendon. And Murphy in 59 introduced the procedure to the U.S. after looking at the results of Esteve in Europe. Perrault and Murphy together in 72 received a Kleinkind Award for their work on resolution of CP equinus using the tendo-Achilles advancement. They reported their results as 9% excellent, 66% good, and 25% poor. Their work was subsequently followed up by others. In 75, Throop et al. Reported a series of 79 procedures on 48 patients with a follow-up of 1 to 4 years, and they found a successful correction of 90%. While in Smith in 74, the first ones to publish the article in the podiatric literature, and as a result of that, the articles, the procedure started being embraced by the podiatric community. Jay and Schoenhaus in 81 discussed the heel button technique. They reported very favorable outcomes. Montgomery and Downey in 87 used a pulley mechanism technique. They also reported very favorable outcomes. Strecker et al. In 83 said they had 98% excellent and good results. Giorgini et al. In 85 reported similar results. They mentioned a problem with boat tailing, where after the Achilles tendon is advanced, the heel becomes prominent against the heel, the shoe, the heel counter, and that was an issue, and they proposed solutions to that. So with all these good results, why is it even an issue? Why do we even talk about it if we know what's the right thing to do? Well, in 1994, Walkers, Stevens, Clark, and Obfell reported on the largest survey that had ever been done. They reported on 90 children, 122 limbs. And they said in their study that they had not great outcomes. They said that they had 11% excellent, 53% good, 35% poor, but they said that the average follow-up time, which also was the longest follow-up time reported, 9.7 years, was not any better than simple heel cord lengthenings, which throws a wrench into the reported outcomes of all the others who had discussed this procedure. So the question, as of mid-90s on, is it better to do a TAL, a tendo Achilles lengthening, or a Murphy-Perot procedure on these patients? We started raising the question when we saw a lot of kids in Mexico who had tendo Achilles lengthenings done. They came back to us with their heels off the ground. They couldn't walk on their heels. And it caused us to think again, why have we abandoned the Murphy-Perot procedure? This is the basic principle of the technique. You advance the tendo Achilles along the dorsal aspect of the calcaneus to an area immediately posterior to the subtalar joint. It shortens the lever arm that is used from the axis of the ankle joint, and therefore it mechanically disadvantages the triceps serrae, the strong flexors that override and cause the equinus. It does not change the resting length of the muscle, which a tendo Achilles lengthening does. And therefore, the muscle doesn't tend to change adversely over time after the procedure is done. I teach biomechanics, so I have to add a little bit of the biomechanical perspective of this. If you take the length of the axis arm from B to C, and you change it from B to D, you find that the distance which it is reduced, which is the distance of D to C, disadvantages the mechanical function by about 48%. By reducing the lever arm that much, you have a 48% disadvantaging, or mechanical disadvantaging. In this case, disadvantage is a good thing, because by disadvantaging the mechanical advantage of the Achilles tendon complex, again, the muscle doesn't have to change in size or scope or circumstance. It remains able to permit the heel to come down to the ground, and it's not going to outgrow that with time. The advancement of the heel cord then allows the person to continue to ambulate without affecting other parts. So the advancement of the heel cord in the posterior aspect of the ankle, while disadvantaging the pull of the tendon Achilles 48%, only affects the, for example, dorsiflexion, first metatarsophalangeal joint, about 15%. So there's an overall benefit ratio that is clear mechanically, theoretically, in sitting down and figuring it out on a paper. Now, we have to take it from there to the real world, and that's what we're attempting to do with our study. The surgical technique that we use is to transect the Achilles tendon at its insertion, to transpose it in front of the flexor lucis longus, which holds the tendon up tight to the posterior aspect of the ankle joint, and then pass it into the calcaneus. By putting it in front of the flexor lucis longus, it prevents bowstringing. Although it poses another little challenge, which I'll mention in a minute, it creates a widening of the first interspace, which with time resolves. And I'll point that out to you. The advantage that we've mentioned is that it decreases resistance to ankle dorsiflexion by 48% while exerting only a 15% deficit in the toe. It reduces equinus but retains the ability to push off. Heel cord lengthening procedures, a traditional tendo Achilles lengthening, at least theoretically, weakens both forces equally. However, in order to be successful, the child must have at least a fair motor strength to begin with. So the patient is placed in the prone position. There's a posterior incision. The ankle joint is identified. Its insertion. It's detached from the tuberosity. It's moved forward. The upper surface of the calcaneus is exposed. The flexor lucis longus is identified and mobilized. There's a trough receptacle formed. And the Achilles tendon is advanced into that old trough receptacle. Then most of us in the project have preferred the McGlamory technique of drilling holes out either side and then using the sides as a pulley to insert the Achilles tendon down into the trough and hold it there. This is the technique. As you can see, the holes are drilled on either side. The sutures passed from the ends of the tendon via a crack carabinel stitch into each of these holes and then transferred back up onto the top and tied off. And that's what it looks like in real life when it's done, hopefully properly. There is the flexor lucis longus tendon holding the tendon in tight against the posterior surface. You want to avoid bow tailing. We found that we can leave the plantaris intact, the little accessory tendon next to the Achilles tendon, to help tent the posterior skin. So although we transfer the Achilles tendon, we'll attempt to leave the plantaris, and that will keep the heel from bow tailing in the shoes. And then an isolated closure, because plastic outcomes are important. Another thing we found in Mexico, a lot of these kids had had surgery done previously that was all closed in one layer, and they run up with these awful scars, and the scars do have a social consequence in their community. People see them, and they limit or adjust their social interaction with people because of this, and getting a nice, pretty closure makes a difference. Do be gentle with a peritenon as you're closing. Post-operative follow-up, we put them in a above-the-knee cast with 15 degrees knee flexion and 0 degrees of equinus. We have a non-weight-bearing cast 4 weeks later. We change to below the knee, and then 2 weeks after that, we get them into a walking cast. So from 1996 to 2007, we've done 72 procedures on 64 patients. The average age is 10.4 years. The range is 4 years to 28 years. 7 patients that we have done had previous TALs and recurrent equinus procedures, or recurrent equinus deformities. And we did this procedure on those along as part of this group, and none of them have had any reoccurrence to this point. This is an example of an outcome on a bilateral case. We consider that to be a fair outcome. If there is any problem with this procedure, it's overcorrection. We just don't see undercorrection. We don't see recurrence of the equinus. We do sometimes see overcorrection. That's a fair outcome. The arch is lower than we would prefer. This is a good outcome. He has a relatively normal-looking arch. Here's a unilateral case. This is a posterior aspect. Again, you can see that the arches have turned out pretty well on these. This is fairly soon after the procedure, and so the scar is very loud on that left view, but in another 6 months, that scar will be almost invisible. And here again, see that little spreading of the toe there? That occurs as a result of the transference of the tendon in front of the flexor lucis longus. And one worry is, or I know I worried the first time we did it, that maybe the great toe would go into hyperflexion, but it didn't. The only outcome was that for some reason it seems to adduct. We've not had, immediately post-op it does seem to flex a little bit, but as they walk on it, it straightens out. And whatever flexion there is replaced by a little bit of adduction of the great toe. Here's another example of a unilateral case from the posterior and anterior aspects. And you know, I would consider that to be a very good outcome. The arch is well preserved. They're walking. They've got a little bit of the spreading of the toe, which is an acceptable consequence. Follow-up so far on our studies range from 6 months to 10 years. The outcomes are based on subjective impressions of the patient. We use the Baker-Wong Facey scale. Let them circle a happy to sad face on a scale of 1 to 10. And that's something that transcends all languages. No matter what language you speak, you can relate to the happy face or the very sad face. And you can choose a subjective area in there, which interestingly sort of tends to work out with the larger numbers. We also use objective testing to include measuring the periodicity of the heel contact and the arc of curvature that's left in the arc. Now, Since 1996, as I said, we've done this on kids aging from ranges 4 years to 28 years. Now, I was hesitant about using this slide because our validation is not as good on this as I'd like to be. This is Mexico. Many of the patients we work on don't have telephones, don't even have addresses. We see them in clinic 2 or 3 times and we don't. And so we ask other people, other communities, friends, and that's second and third hand knowledge, and that's not really reliable data. So when you look at this, I have to qualify this slide. This is not something I publish in an article because it's just not as validated as it should be. But from what we've been able to get, from what information we've gathered through clinical note-taking and asking our friends on things, we know that one of our patients died about 3 years after the procedure was performed, not because of the procedure, but just because of other problems and complications he had. He was actually in his 20s. 18 had gone on to participate in both primary and secondary education systems in Mexico. 28 were still in primary education systems. There were 17 that were unable to pursue further education because the education system there didn't feel that they could provide them the services they needed, what we would in this country call special needs services. And out of those 17, about eight, are gainfully employed in unskilled labor occupations, selling things on the street, working in factories and whatnot. Four of them are homebound and they continue to require family care and are unable to participate. But still, out of the total numbers we've done, that's not a bad number. And we're hoping that as time goes on, we'll be able to maintain about that ratio, and we'll also be able to validate this more completely. The trends to date are that 65% have had excellent outcomes, 25% have had good, 10% have had fair outcomes. We've had no poor outcomes to date, meaning we've had none that have completely reoccurred or none where the child has been unable to ambulate at all as a result of the surgery. So in conclusion, it's a well-understood surgical process. The mechanics of the technique are well understood. It provides for good correction of spastic equinus deformity. It obviates the need for prolonged bracing. It's cost effective. It improves quality of life. And there's a much, much lower rate of recurrence in TAL according to our studies so far. Thank you so much for your time. Do you have any questions? Sir?
Any problems with the plantaris?
That's a good question. The plantaris is a lot more diminutive than the tendon, than the Achilles tendon, and should theoretically pose a risk of rupture. So far, we haven't seen it, but it's something we should probably keep an eye out on. I would think that even if it does rupture, it's likely to reattach within the subcutaneous tissue in the back of the envelope around the watershed area. And would assist or help in resisting the boat tailing that we're concerned about. Sir?
How long have you actually been on site when you're doing these procedures? And what's the quality of the follow-up that you're receiving once you leave?
Typical trip, we go down on a Thursday. We usually spend Thursday afternoon and evening dealing with administrative issues. Friday, we're in surgery, not just these procedures, but many other procedures as well, from about 8 in the morning until sometimes after midnight. Saturday we see them in clinic for post-ops and anticipated future surgeries. And then Sunday we come home. There's an orthopedic surgeon, a very fine man, Dr. Arturo Rios, who's the past president of the Yucatan State Society for Orthopedics and will probably be the president of the Mexican Orthopedic Association in the next couple of years. He coordinates all the follow-up with us. Unlike other projects, for example, the Baja project is a wonderful project and was the model we used to get started. But Baja started through a Rotarian affiliation. And they've continued through this Rotarian affiliation to build their project. They don't really have any state sanction. I first went down in 92, and we spent 4 years exchanging documents with the Minister of Health and things between the university. So we have state sponsorship on our project. And the state was the one that assigned us originally Dr. Zapata and later Dr. Rios. And they've been wonderful about following up with us. So if they give us emails to let us know surgical outcomes, and when we go back on subsequent trips, we get them to bring in the patients, and they provide transportation, and we track them on subsequent notes. It's not as ideal, as I mentioned before, as it would be here. In the States, we have phones and whatnot, and we have solid addresses. But overall, the file's been very good. One other little thing I might mention, the complication rate down there, so far we've seen, is so much better than it is here. They've never seen a case of MRSA down there. They don't have all the nosocomial infections that we have here, and they're not as prone to being overtreated down there as we are here. So there have been, fortunately, there have been relatively few complications. There have been some. It's inevitable that if you do enough surgery, you'll have some. But overall, the phallus have been very good. And that's borne out also in the Baja Project. They did a 10- and 20-year prospective study that showed that their outcomes were equal to outcomes here in the States long-term. Well, again, I want to thank you very much for your time.